Welcome. Good afternoon. I am Joanne Lynn, and I'm very proud to say that I now serve the wonderful city of Washington, D.C. as the Bureau Chief for Cancer and Chronic Disease, and I'm especially proud to say that since my previous employer, your Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, would not allow me to be identified with them. So there. Recognizing this is the last time that part of the planning committee addresses the forum, I wanted to take the opportunity to thank you all for coming and sharing your triumphs and your challenges, sharing the ways around problems and how to measure them. I hope you have as many ideas and contacts to follow up as I do. Remember that IHI is not really the organization that sits in Cambridge. It's all of us and our willingness to share and be generous with our ideas and our efforts, and to be committed to the idea that we could build a healthy community relying on a care system that is efficient and that is effective and that we can afford to have as we grow old together, echoing John Kitzhaber's words earlier. We also, of course, want to build a process of change that has us help one another whenever possible and move farther, faster than we could possibly do alone. I want to take a minute to thank all the IHI blue shirts. All of us owe them a round. There's just no other meeting that I ever attend that runs as smoothly as this, and there's always someone right at your elbow ready to tell you where you need to be and encouraging and asking if everything's going well. So thanks to all. Please do let everyone at IHI know how the forum went for you and how other programs are working well, and be sure to reach out and bring your colleagues and friends to the meeting next year in Orlando on December 6th and 9th. And maybe especially reach out and bring those who are obstructing your way. You know, it's not just the friends and colleagues, but those who you are finding a problem. And they'll get their heads turned around and their hearts in the right place. I now have the great pleasure to introduce our last plenary speaker, a very special lady. She has been the head of the health unit and the on-air health correspondent for the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer on PBS. For the last decade, and while she still maintains a link with the NewsHour, she is now Editor-in-Chief of Health Affairs, which the Washington Post has called the nation's health policy Bible. So with that, let me introduce the Chief Scribe of the Health Policy Bible, Susan Dentzer.
Thank you so much, Joanne, and good afternoon to all of you. It really is an honor and a privilege. I can't tell you how much of an honor and a privilege it is to be your final speaker for this conference. It's very sobering to be the person who ends a conference that was kicked off by that inspiring speaker to end all speakers, John Berwick. Followed by what I understand was a real tour de force by F. Murray Abraham and company, and then to be preceded this morning by John Kitzhaber, all of whom I understand completely knocked it out of the park. So this is my humble task, is to try to even rise somewhere up toward that level. I hope I get at least a bit near it, and I hope you feel at the end of it that you did make the right decision today to stay here and listen to me when you could have gone outlet shopping or Christmas caroling or listening to rockabilly, Christmas carol music, whatever else there is to do here today at the good old Opryland. I believe that final plenary speeches should be PowerPoint-free zones, so I'm not going to inflict upon you a PowerPoint today. I'm actually going to speak and speak really, I hope, passionately from the bottom of my heart, mainly because I understand I'm in one of the most passionate audiences that could ever exist around any topic, and especially around this topic. You don't have to be slogging around the trenches of healthcare for a quarter century, as I have, really to understand how much talent and passion there is in this room. I decided a long time ago as a journalist that there are some things that you hope in public life you never find out the answer to. I hope, for example, that we as a nation never find out again how we respond to a terrorist attack. I hope that we as a nation, I believe that we as a nation more or less decided that we didn't want to find out the answer to the question, what happens if you let the big three automakers go bankrupt? I think we've decided now we're not going to find out the answer to that. I know for certain that I never want to know the answer to this question. What would have happened if there had not been a quality improvement movement launched in U.S. healthcare, and what would have happened if there had never been an IHI? We will never have to ask that question, and thank goodness for the country that that is so. Over my three decades now as a journalist, first covering general business news as I started out doing at Newsweek many years ago, then moving on to cover Wall Street as I did, then moving into general economics coverage, then healthcare economics, finally healthcare policy, and now basically almost everything to do with health and healthcare. Over that entire period, needless to say, I've covered multiple periods of boom and a bust. I've covered periods when people believed that, quite plausibly, that trees would grow to the sky. And then, of course, as the trees got higher and higher and higher, the root systems weakened, if you will, and the trees eventually fell. I've covered periods when, as the famed British financial journalist Walter Bagehot once wrote, quote, "A great many stupid people have a great deal of stupid money." I've covered many of those. Along the way, I even did a tour in international economic coverage, and I covered the economic collapse of the former Soviet Union and the Soviet economy. That was messy indeed. It was probably the most eye-opening lesson I've ever had, though, into what I would argue is the single most important understanding I've had as a journalist, which is understanding the way things truly work. It's probably a little bit like the lesson that's applicable this week to covering politics in Illinois, if I may say so. But that's just an aside. I remember some of the very important lessons I learned while covering the collapse of the former Soviet Union. There was a great old economist at the Brookings Institution in Washington named Ed Hewitt, who had been following the Soviet economy for years and had written several landmark books on the subject. I call him an old economist because at the time he seemed old to me. He was all of 50, and I was in my early 30s. My, how our perspective changes. Ed actually went on to work for the National Security Council in the Bush 1 administration, and then he died tragically of renal cancer at the age of 50. But I've never forgotten some of the lessons I learned from him, and I've thought of them many, many times since, even as I've covered, moved on into covering areas like healthcare. One of the lessons was from Ed's books about the Soviet economy. As you may recall, you students of economic history, it was referred to as a planned economy. But there was one major problem with it. It didn't follow the plan because people don't often follow the plan. So one of Ed's books was actually divided in half. The first half was about the way the plan was supposed to work, and the second half of the book was about the way the Soviet economy actually worked. And needless to say, there was very little overlap between the two halves. I've thought of that many times as I've contemplated how various systems operate as distinct from how they are designed to operate. You may sense some parallels to healthcare in that. I've also remembered something else that Ed once said to me. As the Soviet economy was limping very badly along in the late 1980s, shortages of goods were massive, of food, long queues around the government-run stores virtually everywhere in the country, clear hardship and duress among the people, a nearly worthless ruble. But somehow the Soviet regime was hanging on. Ed said to me at one point as I was remarking in amazement about all this, he said, you know, you'll discover in your life that some things go on much, much longer than you could ever reasonably expect them to, even though they seem to get worse and worse and worse. And then, all of a sudden, in a moment, it falls apart. Now, he probably said this to me in about 1988 or 1989. And then suddenly in 1989, the Berlin Wall, fell. This was after decades when most of us probably assumed it would be standing forever. And then in 1991, the Soviet Union, our mortal enemy for much of the 20th century, the enemy that I used to crawl under my kindergarten desk for because we were so convinced it was going to drop bombs on us, suddenly that enemy was gone. It had suddenly collapsed. Well, it was probably about the same time that I had that interview with Ed that I also had contact with a number of other Soviet economists who, in the era of glasnost, or openness at the time, were suddenly being allowed to travel to the United States. These were all very erudite people, and surprisingly, some of them were extremely funny. You don't think Soviet economists laughing on the floor. It doesn't compute, but they were. And they would regale me with jokes about Soviet life. One of the jokes went as follows. Why is life in the Soviet Union like being with Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden? The answer is we have no food, no clothes, and we're told we are in paradise. Another joke was positively mordant. This was the era of glasnost, after all, some openness, but it wasn't extreme openness, as, of course, it's not clear they have now in Russia. The joke goes as follows. A man goes all around Moscow putting up large signs. He hangs them in the subway. He hangs them on the walls of the Kremlin. All over the place, they're ubiquitous. But interestingly, these large signs are big white sheets of paper that happen to be entirely blank. No words, nothing. Well, one night he's doing this, he's hanging up one of these big blank sheets of paper, and a police car screeches up, the secret police get out, they apprehend him, they beat him virtually to a pulp, and then they haul him off to secret police headquarters, where he undergoes very intense questioning. He doesn't give an inch during this intense questioning, but so eventually the chief of the secret police shows up and asks him, okay, why you hang posters with no message? And the man replies, there's no need for a message because the message is known to everyone. The message is known to everyone. Now, at this point, you're saying, okay, Dentzer, this has been really interesting to travel with you through your past in journalism, but what the heck does this have to do with healthcare? And I will respond that the message is known to everyone. Here we sit on top of a $2.5 trillion health economy, which is in turn atop an economy that, of course, is experiencing apparently the worst crisis since the Great Depression. And isn't it interesting how, invoking Ed Hewitt, things that we thought would go on forever seem to be falling apart all at once? Car companies selling fuel-inefficient cars that few people apparently want to buy, going on for years and years and years, but now seemingly suddenly falling apart. Wall Street firms that have created more wealth for the people running them than anybody could possibly have imagined, suddenly falling apart all at once. And then there's healthcare, an almost $2.5 trillion system that we know is costing far more per person than anybody else in the world is willing to pay for healthcare, and yet it isn't covering everybody or giving the best possible care to millions. Now, despite IHI's best efforts, despite your best efforts in the room, despite the 5 Million Lives campaign, which we're obviously celebrating the completion of, or at least completion of this phase of, at this conference, despite all of this, we know it isn't as safe a system as it should be, or as value-driven a system as it should be. That message is known to everyone. And in times of distress, this system that is supposed to be helping people turns out to be failing them. And it's not just healthcare that's failing us. It's the entire construct we've created to finance healthcare as well as to provide it. Now, students of history will know that the Blue Cross and Blue Shield plans in this country have their roots in the Great Depression. It's America, after all. Capitalism drives a lot of things, so we can't be surprised to remember that although one would have thought that the system would have been created to help people get health care, in fact, it was mainly created at the instigation of the nation's doctors and hospitals, who were mainly worried about the fact that the patients in the Great Depression were not able to pay their bills. So health insurance as a form of provider income maintenance was born at that time. Silly us, we thought it was about getting people health care. But that was the plan as it was supposed to work. Now we fast forward nearly 70 years to today. Maybe some of you read Robert Pear's story in the New York Times last Sunday about the collapse of a cookie factory in central Ohio and the impact on 275 workers at the factory who are now without jobs. One of them is Starla Darling, age 27. Now, isn't that right out of a Frank Capra movie, Starla Darling? Truth is often better than fiction. Here's what happened to the hero of our story, Starla Darling. She was pregnant when the cookie factory crumbled. She learned that her insurance coverage would end in October of this year. Inconveniently enough, that was a little bit ahead of her baby's due date. So Robert Pear wrote to us all what happened next. Quote, she rushed to the hospital, took a medication to induce labor, and then had an emergency C-section in the hope that her Blue Cross and Blue Shield plan would pay for the delivery. Quote, I was determined that we were getting this baby out and it was going to be paid for, said Ms. Darling, who was interviewed at home as she cradled the infant in her arms. Robert continues, as it turned out, the insurance company denied her claim, leaving Ms. Darling with more than $17,000 in medical bills. So it seems unlikely that the hospital where Ms. Darling had her baby will get paid. It's unlikely that Ms. Darling will have the money to pay. Who knows if she'll get a job again anytime soon in depressed Ohio? Who knows if she'll get health coverage again? Oh, and by the way, did you hear that insurance company that stiffed her in her hospital? Blue Cross. Now, I think there are plenty of people in this room at Blue's plans who are thinking the same thing I'm thinking, which is that this isn't right. The plan isn't working the way the plan was supposed to work, and it's because the system that we've created, the last half of the book, doesn't match the first half of the book. This is not the way things were supposed to work. Now, many of you are probably thinking that things are about to get very, very different. We have a new administration arriving in Washington with a candidate who promised during his campaign to head the country in the direction of universal health coverage. We have town meetings now being scheduled to let the public air their grievances about health care and their ideas for reform. We have members of Congress heading key committees already talking about their own plans. For example, we have Senator Baucus and Senator Kennedy on different committees vowing to work together to come up with a common plan out of the Senate. And we have advisors to President-elect Obama asserting that notwithstanding our likely trillion-dollar budget deficit in fiscal 2009, notwithstanding our current economic maladies, we must fix health care and health coverage, and expressing every intention of moving forward once the new president takes office. Well, I hope so, and I hope they're right. And I hope that, as people are saying now, in crisis there is opportunity, and I hope we do find the opportunity to create a new system of health coverage for all. And I hope the plan we create this time is a plan that really works the way it was designed to work. I was pregnant with my own first child during the Clinton health reforms, and one of the reformers and I actually had become fairly friendly. Yes, this does happen in journalism. Sometimes you actually get to like your sources. This person was a very caring person, and she asked me to call her and let her know when the baby was born. So right on the eve of the collapse of the Clinton health plan, our little Willie did arrive, and so I called her and I left her a message that the baby was, in fact, here, and that he looked forward to seeing universal coverage in his lifetime in America. Well, he's 14 years old, going on 15. He's still waiting, and we're all still waiting. Even though I'm hoping to be pleasantly surprised by the passage of a plan that leads us toward universal coverage, I find myself much less optimistic about a lot else happening in U.S. healthcare anytime soon. Sometimes I remind myself of another joke I once heard about the Soviet economy. The joke went as follows. This was, again, from the late 80s when things were looking really, really bad. The joke said, in the Soviet Union, there are only two types of economists, the optimists and the pessimists. The pessimists think things could not possibly get any worse than they are. The optimists think, oh, no, things could definitely get much, much worse. Sometimes I think I'm a Soviet-style optimist about U.S. healthcare, in that I think things can and indeed probably will get much worse than they are. This is frustrating to me, and it creates a sense of cognitive dissonance because I really am a very optimistic person by nature. Some of you may have read the study that was just published by Nick Christakis at Harvard and Jim Fowler that basically said optimism goes in networks, social networks. You know, if you're around optimistic people, you're optimistic, and vice versa, it's catching. That's me. I like to think of myself as optimistic. I always admired Ronald Reagan's line about how he was like the little boy who, if he saw a huge pile of manure somewhere, he got all excited because he was sure there was a pony inside it. And if you sit where I sit at the helm of health affairs, you see plenty of manure. This is not a comment about the great research and the distinguished authors we publish. This is a comment about what they're writing about. It's a comment about the subject matter of U.S. healthcare and health delivery and health financing. Uwe Reinhardt at Princeton, who is probably the MVP of health economists in America, has written for us about what he calls Alfred E. Newman's inflexible law of U.S. healthcare. Here's where I have to stop and explain who Alfred E. Newman was to many people and what Mad Magazine was. And in a couple years, I'll have to explain to people what a magazine was. So far, though, I think enough of you know Alfred E. Newman to know why this is a funny reference. I won't have to footnote it for you. Alfred E. Newman's inflexible law of U.S. healthcare, as rendered by Uwe Reinhardt, is that a dollar of somebody's health spending is a dollar of somebody's healthcare income. So anytime we talk about ratcheting down health spending, we're going to run into a buzzsaw because somebody's income is involved. And so our recent medical technology issue at Health Affairs, just published in November, focused on, among other things, the seemingly unstoppable rise in medical imaging and the curious coincidence that much of this seems linked to physicians installing CT scanners in their own offices. Who would have thought? Or the medical device industry and the Soviet-style practice of banning hospitals and other large purchasers who buy devices from these device manufacturers, barring them from discussing with anybody the prices they receive on bulk purchases of devices, lest they disclose the fact that they got a good deal and prompt other greedy purchasers to want the same. Welcome to U.S. healthcare. Or, in Health Affairs, you can read the analysis of Mike Chernew and colleagues from Harvard, who published an article several years ago looking at the long-term affordability of healthcare in America. Now, health spending, as you know, has been rising, roughly speaking, at about 6 to 7% a year overall, and that's about 2 percentage points faster than real growth in per capita GDP. If the growth rate in health spending, however, were to fall from 2% above real per capita GDP to just 1% above real per capita GDP, that is more or less cutting the growth rate in half, Mike Chernew and his colleagues found that healthcare would then be, quote, affordable for us as a nation. Why? Because from now until 2075, the entire projection period they looked at, only 55% of the increase in real income over that entire period would go to healthcare. That would make all of it affordable. That's as compared to a situation where it stays growing at 2 percentage points above GDP, in which case only 120% of the increase in real income over that period goes to healthcare. In other words, it's impossible. It doesn't happen unless healthcare massively begins sucking in resources from all other areas of the economy, like cars, kind of like it's doing now, only on steroids. So if we could get health spending down by about 1 percentage point, we have a happy story. The problem is, we don't appear to have any real idea of how to do that, at least not an idea that Americans seem willing to live with. Joanne Lynn, the great lady who just introduced me, has pointed out that one out of every $8 in Medicare is spent on care in the last month of someone's life. Now, if you could cut that month by just a week, it would save more money than any other cost containment idea on the table. And if we had the luxury of asking people who had spent the last month of their lives in intensive care units or similar facilities, similar areas, and if we asked them, would you have given up that extra week? I have a sneaky feeling they would have said yes. Then we look at the Dartmouth Atlas, and we see these huge, unexplainable variations in care that is delivered to the chronically ill in the last phase of life. We think, well, maybe it would be possible to rationalize this. And then we remember Ian Morrison's famous dictum about Americans, that Americans think death is really just an option, a lifestyle choice that we can avoid if we really try. Well, in a way, I would say that as I look from healthcare across to the financial system meltdown and the system that I used to cover, I have a certain amount of financial system meltdown envy on behalf of U.S. healthcare. Here's why. The financial system meltdown is forcing wrenching changes in things that should have changed a long time ago. Not like, for example, a proliferation of banks throughout the U.S. that we probably haven't needed for a long time, and huge fat cat bonuses for CEOs. The meltdown has been one of the ultimate in action-forcing mechanisms that's forced things that seemed as if they could go on forever when they have no reason to, force them to fall apart all at once. I'm not so sure we have an action-forcing mechanism at hand that's going to force U.S. healthcare to get a whole lot more cost-effective, a whole lot safer, a whole lot more patient-focused, and produce a whole lot more real value for all of us than it's doing right now. I sometimes can't see my way clear to the action-forcing mechanism that would really force all of the established interests in the system, the people whom we politely call stakeholders, to change. And beyond healthcare, I worry about the nation's health. We know from decades of research that most of our health status is not, in fact, determined by the health care we receive, but by the so-called social and economic determinants of health. What income level of the family we were born into and raised by? What income level did we attain as adults? Where did we grow up? Did it happen to be in a slum or a nice suburb or next to a toxic waste dump? We know that if we're better educated and have higher incomes, we're more likely to be healthy and to maintain our health because we engage in healthy behaviors. And we can see that much of the country is not going in that direction. It's going in the wrong direction. A study by researchers at the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins and at ARC and at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine that was published last summer in the online issue of the journal Obesity projected that if the current gains in weight and obesity continue, an estimated 86% of adult Americans, almost 9 out of every 10 of us, will be close to being obese or obese by 2030. In today's dollars, the increase in real spending related to that rise would approach $1 trillion a year. Some things that can't go on forever have to stop. What mechanism do we have to rein that one in? We also know that recent decades have brought us unbelievable and seemingly unstoppable trends of widening income disparities. The top of the income distribution is pulling further and further away from the middle, and the middle is pulling away from the bottom. We're seeing the same trends in health status, wherein life expectancy for those at the top of the income distribution continues to rise, whereas elsewhere and in certain parts of the country is actually falling. As Majid Azadi and some of his Harvard colleagues have shown, since 1980, very troubling disparities have begun to crop up in these trends in life expectancy, with some areas of the country clearly experiencing stagnation or even decline, partly because of trends like obesity. In about a third of counties across the country, life expectancy is actually falling. That's more than 1,000 counties where life expectancy is falling. It fell significantly in 11 counties for men over the period since 1980, and in 180 counties for women by as much as 1.3 years. Now, the drop appears to stem from a halt in the declining rate of deaths from cardiovascular disease, coupled with a moderate rise in lung cancer, chronic lung disease, and diabetes. The Washington Post put an incredibly vivid face on these statistics in a story that ran last April. It was headlined, "Southwest Virginia's Mortality Mystery, More Than Diet Behind Women's Sharp Life Expectancy Drop." The lead of the story was about a 56-year-old woman named Esther Britt. Now, keep in mind, for a 56-year-old woman, that means she was born in 1952 when female life expectancy in this country was 71 years. Today, female life expectancy at birth is almost 80 years. Here's the story about Esther Britt. Quote, "Esther Britt lay in an oversized casket, the color of an overcast sky. She wasn't always so heavy, but relatives say a string of illnesses and unhealthy choices pushed her weight past 350 pounds and led her here Wednesday afternoon, lying at age 56 in Stephen's funeral home. Britt had suffered from gallbladder disease, a degenerative disc in her back, bursitis in a shoulder, arthritis in another shoulder, carpal tunnel syndrome, a hiatal hernia, and diabetes. She smoked a pack and a half of cigarettes a day and ate as much as she wanted," her relatives said. In other words, she was a walking public health disaster in one of the poorer counties of the United States. She even had health insurance. You might say, as some would, that she had no sense of personal responsibility. You might also say that there was no public health system that had a sense of personal responsibility for her either. So Esther Britt lost an average of 15 years of her life, or maybe even close to 25 years of her life, depending on your life expectancy benchmark. In the one place in the U.S. Where she was born, where the pain has been felt the worst. But she has thousands of sisters and brothers like her just across this great country, as we all know. This trend of declining life expectancy in certain parts of America is the kind of trend that isn't usually associated with high-income countries like ours. It happens to be exactly what happened after the fall of the Soviet Union, though, when the health and social networks that had once tied together Eastern Europe fell apart. So I look around, and I can't quite see on the horizon the action-forcing mechanism that forces us really to take action and to stop this trend. And the only action-forcing mechanism that seems to have checked this underlying trend in widening income distribution appears to be the fact that we're now heading into this worst period of economic decline since the Great Depression. So that means that so far the only thing we figured out how to halt the widening gap in income distribution is at least temporarily to just push everybody down a few notches, maybe more than a few. And heaven knows what will happen to the trend of widening income distribution when the economy recovers and starts growing again, as surely it will. So you can see that I can talk myself into feeling rather gloomy, but then given my inherent nature as an optimist, I do become upbeat again. I would call myself an American-style optimist. I'm the one who agrees with that famous line from Winston Churchill, who once said that Americans always do the right thing after they've exhausted all the other alternatives. Like Ronald Reagan, I see, amid the manure, signs of ponies that must be everywhere. I see them when I come to IHI conferences and I read about the case studies of those of you who have done some really extraordinary things, like innovating in the rapid response realm or like preventing cases of ventilator-associated pneumonia. I actually did a story on that for the NewsHour while I was still there. I went out to Community Hospital East in Indianapolis, which at the time had gone, I think it was a full year or close to it, without a case of VAP. And I have just heard today, as I sat in on a lunch that some of the mentor hospitals had that were involved in the 5 Million Lives campaign, I heard that there are now 65 hospitals in the campaign, now that it's come to its conclusion, that have gone a full year without a case of VAP or VAP. I did this story. I went out and interviewed people who were involved in this effort at Community Hospital East. I know firsthand now how much hard, careful, mind-numbingly detailed work goes into delivering reliable systems like that. It sounds so simple, but it's not. Doing the right thing for the right patient at the right time in a very, very complex operating environment over and over and over again is hard. It means having a plan at the front of the book that matches the plan at the back of the book. And most of you who have prevented all these cases of VAP or achieved any of the other goals of the 5 Million Lives campaign did so not because you earned more money in some pay-for-performance scheme. You did it because it was the right thing to do. And I can almost hear you neighing right now because you are my ponies. You are the people who give us all reason to go on. I see ponies all the time galloping across the pages of Health Affairs, too, along with the gloom and doom. I read, for example, the great David Lawrence, formerly of Kaiser Permanente, writing about reorganizing healthcare around the concept of care platforms designed to deliver consistently reliable, lower-cost care with accountability for individuals and for the entire system and constant R&D to improve the design. Now, I'll know this concept has really hit the big time when I turn on my television set someday, and instead of seeing House with that really gorgeous Hugh Laurie, I don't see that. I see a show not called House, but a show called Care Platforms. And instead of being organized like House is around five doctors who seem to deliver every aspect of care for every patient at the fictitious Princeton Plainsboro Hospital, even doing and processing their own lab tests and imaging, doing their own autopsies, or rather the autopsies of their own patients, they'll probably do their own autopsies in some episode in the future. My favorite one was where they sneaked into a cemetery to dig up a body so they could do their own post-mortem. It's just great television. Well, instead of that, we'd have a show called Care Platforms, where sane groups of providers would share responsibilities broadly across a cooperative team and deliver the right care to the right patient at the right time. Doesn't that sound exciting? Maybe this is why I'm not in television full-time anymore. Well, whether that would amount to exciting television or not, we know that happily enough, concepts like this are already rolling out in places like Duke University Medical Center's Congestive Heart Failure Clinic, which, as David Lawrence noted in his piece for us, has a system where, for example, a cardiologist and a nurse practitioner undertake an initial evaluation of a patient. After that, the nurse practitioners use standardized protocols to manage patients' medications, to coach them in self-care, to undertake phone outreach for them, to coordinate occasional visits. There are dietitians who teach culturally appropriate eating to all the patients. They pay special attention to local foods that people can use. Duke also coaches lay community members to teach patients how to shop for healthy and affordable food. What a concept that people sometimes learn best from not from the people in white coats, from the people who look just like them. What an idea. It underscores one of the really obvious things to me about system improvement, which is that sometimes the problem is the truly obvious things aren't done. The message is known to everyone, but nobody acts on it. Everybody just ignores it because of all the other messages that are flying around and screwing up our heads. I see ponies in a forthcoming issue on chronic disease and chronic care that we have coming out in January. Now, I'm going to stretch my journal's own embargo just a tad to tell you that we'll have in that volume a paper that synthesizes all the evidence that's built up around the famous chronic care model, pioneered by Ed Wagner and his colleagues at Group Health Puget Sound. If you read this paper, and I hope you will, it tells you that we really have pretty much figured out how to manage chronic disease in a way that produces superior outcomes for patients. It may not be the be-all and end-all, but it's pretty darn good. The problem is we just don't do it enough. This, too, is at least a tiny pony to me, because at least we have a part of the answer. Now we just have to take this pony and feed it growth hormone and get it ramped up and used much more broadly, if not nationwide. And beyond healthcare, to the area of improving the public health, I think we can see tiny, tiny little ponies galloping across the horizon as well. In Congress and in the incoming Obama administration, we see an increased consensus about our need to shift America's sick care system into a health preservation and a health optimization system. We don't know quite how to do it, and we don't have a total grip on everything we'll need to do it, but at least a sense of consensus has emerged on that. We even hear that health information technology is going to be incorporated into the Obama administration's planned economic stimulus package because the Obama folks and those in Congress, because they recognize that building, just like building the interstate highways, building an HIT system as a fundamental piece of the new care platform across the country is truly going to be a critical investment in the 21st century health infrastructure. We hear calls to invest in building a smarter healthcare workforce with more nurses and more public health workers joining an expanded core of better paid primary care physicians and other primary care providers who are all engaged in delivering the right care to the right patient at the right time. And guess what? Working to their full scope of practice at that. What a concept. Well, it's all these ponies that keep me going, and they keep all of us going, I think, amid the other stuff that we see around them. And we know that when there are ponies, there can indeed be a pony express. We could do better. We can do better. We could move farther. We could move faster. The message is known to everyone, or at least to everyone here today, that we can move faster, we can do better, and we must. Well, if it sounds like I might be someone who actually has what could be termed the audacity of hope, it's because I do, and I know you do as well. And it's not just what I would call audacious hope. I'd call it tenacious hope. It is really hope that won't let go despite all the manure flung its way. So it's audacious hope. It's tenacious hope. You could even call it badass hope. I share it. I know all of you in this room share it. I thank you for letting me be here today to share it with you. Congratulations to all of you, and Godspeed. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Susan. Thank you so much, Susan. It's always amazing to hear an absolute master journalist hold the mirror up before us and show us what's really going on. It's my pleasant and but somewhat bittersweet task to bid you adieu now and wish you well. I want to close by thanking again the IHI colleagues of mine who made this meeting possible, especially I want to mention Emily Kreitz and Jenna Ward, who took responsibility for seeing that this meeting went right. They did a spectacular job. And to Joanne Lynn and Vinsani and Howard Hyatt and Brent James, who gave this program its shape as our co-chairs and our leaders. I'll make a few comments in closing. I'll be really brief, I promise. First, thank you all. Coming here, those of you who came from 42 countries, 6,000 of you here today, did in so doing make a vote of confidence about doing what we need to do and not letting the pressures and the distractions that we all know are about and that Susan recited stand in the way of getting the job done that we need to get done. And the 17,000 people that are listening on satellite broadcasts, 23,000 people attended this forum, either electronically or in person, that's got to be a vote of optimism and play to the optimistic side of Susan Dentzer. This is trust, it's commitment, it's generosity. You all gain by doing that, but man, do you all give. And the amount of exchange has been just thrilling to watch. You know, our surveys after the forum, people here tend to say they got their tank refueled. I want to tell you it works both ways, that IHI gets its tank refueled by hearing your enthusiasm, your commitment. Thank you so much. If I had to think of one word to describe my experience here the past few days, I guess the word is challenge. We challenged you. We have the improvement map now to work on hard. That's raising the stakes. We had a Atul Gawande's challenge, the sprint. I really care about that one. Imagine what would happen if in a breathtakingly short amount of time, 90 days we're proposing, we can make a change that good, that fast, that widely. That will change the game. And I want us to try to do that. That's a challenge. From the play that Bob Brustein so ably put together, holding a mirror up to nature is said in Hamlet, it was hard-hitting. It was honest. There were understandings and misunderstandings, but that is how we're seen. And we have the challenge of seeing ourselves as others see us and knowing what to do with that information, affirming sometimes, questioning sometimes, but always informative. John Kitzhaber's challenge was as eloquent as any I've ever heard. I think it amounts to deciding what we want. And he's putting the question as clearly as I have ever put it. It is the question we're going to have to deal with in order to get together and get done what we want. We first have to know what we want. John invited a flood of ideas at the end by posting his website. We and IHI would like to help him get those ideas. And so through our website, I'm going to ask that we act as a hub so you can shunt your ideas, all 23,000 of you, to John. And let's keep him up a few nights with all that input. Susan Dentzer, with the steely honesty of a world-class journalist, told us what is going on, and then she expressed her optimism and her hope. But she said the message is known to everyone, and the challenge there is to do it, to be up to it. And I guess it's the question we have to face, which is, are we up to it? I think we are. Susan mentioned Mad Magazine, and this is a completely irrelevant mental connection, but maybe it'll mean something to you. I remember I used to read Mad, but now I'm modern, so I read The Onion. And I do remember The Onion headline that read, witnesses say roadkill squirrel appeared confused, indecisive. I don't want to be the squirrel. Diffusion and indecision is not what's called for right now. It's decision and it's direction, and we've got to be up to it. So many people said they want to send that second letter to Jessica, and so do I. I remember on another climb of Mount Rainier, a guide was guiding my wife. We were climbing together at that time across a crevasse, and Anne was a bit scared. And the guide turned to her and said, "You know, Anne, nothing requires you to imagine falling." We'll be together again. We're going to get this job done. We'll be in Orlando together, I hope, on December 6th through 9th. I invite you all to come. Bring three others. Let's have the next forum be even more buoyant, even more full of optimism and confidence than this one. I was very excited about the 20th forum after our two decades as something to celebrate. And then I realized next year's forum will be 21. That means we'll be adults. And yes, we can drink legally. That's not the point. It means that we've got a hard job, we've got to face it, and then we have to do it. Safe travels home.